Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tierney ou le grand pont pour éliminer Furlong. Qu'est-ce qu'il lui a fait là? Qu'est-ce qu'il lui fait, Kieran Tierney? Kieran Tierney, c'est quoi? C'est quoi ça? Il vient souhaiter une très bonne année aux supporters d'Arsenal. Kieran Tierney, quel rush! Magnifique! Magnifique! Magnifique!
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra. As always, we're James from Gunnerblog. James, goodly morning to you.
Goodly morning to you too, Andrew. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Yeah, it's been a strange kind of weird interlull, I think.
Yeah.
Feels like, I don't know quite how it feels like, actually. It feels weird. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just my end. Things feel a bit weird. Maybe it's just a general overarching weirdness, you know, over the last few months. But it just feels a bit weird. Like, I've forgotten what the last Arsenal game was very quickly.
Yeah, and this is a weird West Ham. International. West Ham. But this is a weird international break as well, right? Because senior teams are qualifying for a Christmas World Cup in before we've even played the Euros. The under-21 teams are playing the group stage of the European Championships before returning to play the knockouts, I think, in the summer. And it just feels all a bit odd and kind of like everything's been sort of thrown together and jumbled up and none of the matches are happening in the right order. And there is this kind of weird, I suppose the fact that they're international games and international travel is even happening even feels quite odd, doesn't it?
It does. It is all very weird and stuff. It's not going very well for England under 21s, is it? For Eddie Nketiah, Emile Smith Rowe played yesterday.
They've got a talented squad who massively underperform, and I think a lot of scrutiny is going to be on the manager there, Adey Boothroyd, who looks every inch the successor to sort of Stuart Pearce in that position. but it's not going very well for Republic of Ireland either.
Yeah.
Senior team.
No. I mean, I didn't watch.
That is an extraordinary result, though, I think.
It really is. I mean, you know, I was sort of, before that, I had no intention of watching it anyway, but it was like, well, I'm sure, despite how poorly things have been going of late, Ireland can beat Luxembourg.
Yeah.
And then they didn't. They lost to Luxembourg. I mean, I think it's, what, the third game they've won in qualifying competitions of all time, something like that. Maybe I'm wrong there. I don't know. But, like, yeah.
Well, they've not won many. We know that much. It is a pretty extraordinary result. But yeah, I find it interesting. I mean, I've not been glued to the international football. I won't lie to you, Andrew. I'm sort of enjoying a bit of respite from the men's football Premier League calendar.
Yeah, you weren't drawn in just when I thought I was out. They pulled me back in and it's England versus, who was it, Albania? That didn't capture your imagination?
Well, I think Bukayo Saka's withdrawal from the squad kind of effectively ended my interest.
That's good and bad, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I don't know enough to say kind of where on that good badometer it is. But on the one hand, I was relieved because, you know, him going away and playing a load of football is the last thing he needed. But then there is that part of your mind that goes, well, how bad is it that they felt they needed to pull him out? I hope this is kind of a Alex Ferguson international withdrawal where the manager sort of put his foot down and told Ryan Giggs he's not going.
Are you allowed to do that anymore, though? I mean, are you?
I don't know.
I don't know how he got away with it all the years that he did. It's quite incredible, really. But, you know, I don't know. Are there managers that powerful now that they can stop
probably
players?
Probably not. Especially so close to the Euros. I mean, as brilliant as Bukayo Saka has been for Arsenal, there is quite a lot of competition within the England squad. Mm. And I've seen a few people's, you know, chosen squads, a few journalists doing the round, and there have been one or two that haven't had Saka in, which might seem absurd to us, but the position he's played at England is predominantly left back, and they have got a couple of other options there. So, yeah, I think he would have wanted to be with the squad if he could have been. But let's hope the week and the assessment at close quarters does him some good.
Yeah. Yeah, fingers crossed. I mean, he could really use those 2 weeks off, and we're all slightly concerned, aren't we, about the amount of minutes that he's played and whether that might have an effect on him. And somebody made the point to me, apologies, over the weekend on Twitter that, you know, someone like Haaland at Dortmund has played a similar amount of minutes and nobody really worries about him. Although maybe Dortmund fans do. I don't know. Do Dortmund fans worry that at a similar age he's playing a lot of minutes? He does seem a bit like a kind of football terminator, though, you know what I mean?
In that
you could throw him into a vat of liquid metal and he would emerge the far side of it, reconstitute himself and just score some goals.
Yeah, it feels cruel to use the word freak, but there is something freakish about his physicality. And like he does seem... That is almost, I mean, it feels unfair because his technical attributes are so good, but physically he is just a monster of a player. So maybe there is the assumptions around him and his fitness are slightly different.
Yeah.
But it's a very good point nonetheless. I mean, I think the only reason we're really worried about it is because we've seen a little dip in his form as well. I think if he was still playing at the fantastic level he's played for most of the season, maybe we wouldn't be too concerned. But we have now seen some evidence of a dip in his form. And I think that makes everybody, you know, think twice and think, is this guy feeling it a bit now?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. When you're in good form, you don't feel tired. When you're scoring and playing well, you don't feel tired. And, you know, yeah, a few games without a goal or whatever can have an impact. Well, look, you know, we'll keep fingers crossed that nothing too serious has occurred that means he's been withdrawn and that he can get the rest and recuperation and, you know, get that hamstring back to full fitness, if you like. Because there is a big game coming up this weekend, of course. So that's on
Liverpool on Saturday night, right?
Yeah. So we'll talk about that later in the week, I think. Who else has been away? Thomas Partey has been away.
Played for Ghana. Aubameyang scored, I believe, for Gabon.
And made a good assist as well. I think there was a video doing the rounds over the weekend on social media. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, look, if he's gone away and played well and sparked back into life, that can be good for us.
I think it was just the one game for Aubameyang as well, which is ideal, really. You know, something to get his confidence up and then have a little bit of time off. I'm just trying to think. Thomas Partey played for Ghana.
Granit Xhaka,
not,
I assume.
Not particularly well, by all accounts.
Oh, really?
Granit Xhaka, yeah, you would think, right? I mean, he plays all the games for everybody.
Even for teams he's not on, he plays for
them. Yeah, I think he played for England, actually. the England under-21s. Yeah, and of course the other 21s. I mean, it's a big tournament for Eddie Nketiah in some ways. It feels like an opportunity, or felt like, shall we say, an opportunity to put himself really in the shop window rather than kind of push for a first team place at Arsenal. But with the team playing the way they are, I mean, he's barely had a chance to speak of, and
he's really kind of fallen out of favor, I guess, is probably the wrong word, but he was at one point this season remarkably our leading goal scorer for a brief period, and that in part was due to like nobody else scoring any goals. But you know, he was involved quite a lot, and I know we had Europa League games which might have skewed that a little bit, but he was certainly involved at Premier League level as well, and now hasn't been for quite some time. I think the last time he played the Premier League was as a sub, maybe at the end of January, something like that, you know?
But you know, at the end of last season or the start of this season even, there were times where he was picked in Premier League games ahead of... Well, it was Lacazette, really. Aubameyang was playing wide at that time. But that feels like a very long time ago now.
Yes, it does. It does. And, you know, he's got 12 months left on his deal come the summer, so it's another one of the issues that we've got to deal with, you know, when the window opens. Kieran Tierney, I guess, played for Scotland, did he? Probably played 300 minutes in each game.
Yeah, at 400 miles per hour. Yeah, probably. I mean... Yeah, but I haven't heard anything too troubling apart from the Saka news, which is my, you know, saving grace. It's that classic Arsenal fan thing of just wanting players to come back fit.
Yeah, yeah. So there's one more round of games, I think, isn't there, this week?
Yes.
You know, games happening probably tonight, tomorrow and Wednesday. And then that's it for internationals, and then we push on towards the end of the season. So we are going to do some questions. I think the best way to do this particular episode is just take questions in both parts rather than just make it a two-parter, you know?
I think it may be the only way.
May be the only way. So here's a question from our Discord from NYGooner14, who says, what are your thoughts on Fekir as an Odegaard alternative? Stories doing the rounds about Nabil Fekir, who plays currently with Real Betis. So, yeah, what are your thoughts on that guy?
It's an interesting link, isn't it? I saw Charles Watts saying, you know, he is on the list and someone that they're interested in. He'll be 28 this summer, which doesn't strike me as kind of the optimum time to buy a player. And that would worry me slightly, especially as well, given that he is a player with substantial injury history. I mean, he was supposed to join Liverpool at one stage. He had one big injury, particularly. But I don't know too much about his physical history since then. But I know that it was obviously a concern for Liverpool. The age thing is the thing that makes the biggest difference to me. I mean, if you compare signing a 28-year-old with a 22-year-old or whatever Odegaard is, there's a big difference there in terms of where their player is headed in their development over the next 4 to 5 years.
Yeah, it is one of the things that we're going to have to deal with, isn't it? You know, when we do recruit, the need to retain value in players. And to buy players that, you know, may not be with us for the rest of their careers, but could, over the course of a period with us, increase in value and then get sold on and help fund other arrivals and what have you. So I do think that is a consideration for whatever it is we need to do in the transfer market, the age profile of certain players. I mean, we went big on Thomas Partey, and I wouldn't change it, but, you know... you can only do so many of those deals, I think.
And it's not in isolation. You know, we went big on Aubameyang, say, you know, a couple of other contractual ones. So that would be my immediate thing on that. I mean, there's no doubt he's a talented player, very, you know, gifted, skillful, can play a number of positions, can play, you know, primarily in the kind of number 10 role, but he can play out wide on the right as a push, can play up front. So, you know, he's someone who could bring options and would be an alternate to Odegaard potentially. But you'll have to forgive me if I can't get quite as excited about it as I would a potential Odegaard arrival.
Okay, here's another one from the Discord from Gregors, who says, is having Odegaard on loan for another year a good or a bad idea?
Well, my immediate thought is I'm not sure that that will be particularly possible.
No, yeah, leave aside the possibility, but let's just imagine. Let's use our imaginations.
It's tempting, isn't it? Of course it's tempting because, you know, you get to have the player for another 12 months. I'm actually going to go with yes, that would be a decent thing in the circumstances. And the reason is that the club is in such a difficult financial position that I do wonder if 12 months down the line, with 12 months, hopefully, of fans back in stadiums and the added revenue that will bring, maybe they might be in a position the following summer to have a bit more flexibility in terms of how they approach the transfer market. So if someone offered you effectively a year of Odegaard for a fraction of the price of what it would cost to buy a player, then I think in the circumstances, that would be a pretty good option. But I can see the argument for why not to do it. What do you think?
I think basically what you think. If we can get the player for another year, then, you know, it can only be good for us. And the other issue is that his contract has 2 years left at Real Madrid. So then right. You have a year left on his contract there, and they have to make a decision. You know, might mean they have to make a decision this summer on him, whether they give him a contract extension or whether they decide to, you know, move him on and cash him in. But just, you know, bottom line, however it happens, if we had him in our team, in our squad next year, I'd be very happy. So,
how about Madrid give him this summer a 10-year contract extension, but the first 5 of those are spent on loan with Arsenal?
Yep, I'll take it.
Yeah. Okay, what about this for a question? Sean Mann says, given the complete lack of funds this summer, is it worth considering deploying Torreira beside Partey in our midfield for the new season?
Oh, yeah. We had one from the Discord as well about that, from Jithin Krishnan, who says, is Torreira-Partey partnership serviceable in midfield? The player seems to want to come back, and at least going by his form in the first season at the club, surely this is a player we can make good use of to add defensive solidity in front of the back four.
Mm.
I'm not sure how much he wants to come back.
No.
To be perfectly honest.
I think the understanding I have is obviously he'd be happy to come back if he felt he was going to play. But I think, you know, he really did want to move to Spain last summer. And I think it will be his priority to stay in Spain or Italy if he can.
I mean, what do you think of the situation at Atletico in that, look, he's hardly played. He's only played something like 600-700 minutes of La Liga football for Atletico Madrid. And, you know, when he went there, people spoke about how much of a fit he would be for someone like Diego Simeone, you know, the kind of football that he wants to play, you know, an aggressive defensive midfield player, blah, blah, blah. He's going to fit in perfectly, South American mentality, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, is it just a case that, you know, they've been so good this season that his chances are few and far between, or is he playing a very specific role? I think you wrote about him over the weekend, didn't you? And talked about him as somebody who comes on late in games to do a specific job there. But, you know, he can't be happy with the way that loan has gone.
No, he can't be at all. And when he signed, he spoke about how, you know, he was desperate to work with Simeone. They'd had a really good conversation about his place and his plans. And it hasn't materialised at all. It's funny, if you speak to different people on different sides of the deal, some say, well, look, Simeone just doesn't fancy him as much as he thought he might and hasn't really wanted to use him. There is also a kind of a conspiratorial idea that Atletico are kind of trying to keep the player's value down, either so they can you know, acquire him permanently for less this summer, or just to kind of spite Arsenal for nicking Thomas Partey off them on deadline day last year. I'm not sure I buy that personally, just because I don't think managers tend to do that. I think they, you know, if a player's useful to them, they pick him, and he hasn't needed to pick him. I don't think he can be particularly confident of staying at Atleti, but there were clubs who tried to sign him in January, and I wonder if some of those will come back for him in the summer. It's an interesting one, midfield, because players are going to go out. Right, I mean, Dani Ceballos, let's say, is probably unlikely to be at Arsenal next season.
I would not put any money on it if I were a betting man, which I'm not. But there you go.
Which leaves you with, you know, Granit Xhaka, Thomas Partey, Mohamed Elneny, and Joe Willock, and Matteo Guendouzi. But personally, I don't see Guendouzi or Torreira being part of the squad next season.
I mean, might it be a case that we have to use one of them? You know what I mean? And look, I'm like you. I don't really think that Torreira wants to be at Arsenal. Or he, not that he doesn't want to be at Arsenal. That's wrong to say. I think he would prefer to be somewhere else. You know.
So,
You know, and I think Guendouzi's bridges are pretty much burned with Mikel Arteta. And I don't really believe there's any kind of future for him, particularly given that he's got a year left on his contract. And you know, I just cannot see Arsenal giving him a new deal or anything like that. So
no. But Torreira's situation is not the same as Guendouzi's, is it?
No.
The bridges aren't burnt to the same degree. And what happened with Elneny, you know, it does show that Arteta is prepared to offer players kind of a way back. It wasn't his choice to send Elneny out, it's worth remembering. But, you know, no one anticipated him becoming part of the first team squad, and he's managed it. Torreira maybe could be involved to kind of make up the numbers, but I don't, like you, I don't think it'll be his first choice. And I think if someone comes to the club with respectable money from him, I think they'll be inclined to take it. That will be the issue, though. I mean, my sort of broad thought about the summer is that I think it's the case every summer that we probably don't do as much business as fans anticipate. You know, we all draw up our list of, well, he could go, and then we'll need a left back, a central midfielder, a right back, a striker. And invariably, not all those things happen. Mm. I kind of wonder if that will be the case more than ever this summer.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, but I also think that our circumstances in some ways demand that we address as many of those issues as possible. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because it's one thing saying we need this, that, and the other when you're finishing top four season after season and you're in the Champions League. But when you're on course for probably the lowest finish in, you know, is it the lowest finish in living memory? Potentially. Where did we finish last year? I've forgotten.
It's the lowest finish in my living memory, pretty much, because I barely remember 94, 95, was it? When we finished 12th.
12th.
I think it will be.
So we finished 8th last season, and we're probably likely to finish there or thereabouts, somewhere in that region again. Now, we could, of course, have a storming end to the season, and I have a question about that, which I'll save for part two. But the need to rebuild, the need to improve, the need to make progress probably demands that you do as many of the things as you can possibly do, whereas, you know, we say, well, we need competition for the goalkeeper, we need a backup left back, we need maybe to do something at right back. Central midfield, we really need to do something there. Center of defense, oh boy, we need to do something there. We've got to sort out the creative element of the midfield. We're fine in terms of personnel when it comes to numbers in, you know, the forwards and the top, that front three, but like, who's going to be the striker? Do we need a backup striker? Do we need to, you know, replenish, rejuvenate, all of those things? So I think there is probably a lot going on, or a lot that's likely to go on. But of course, there are so many individual situations that you can name that it's going to be really complicated. Really, really complicated. So, I mean, on that, the Gunnar Talk at the Gunnar Talk TV says, not naming names, but how do you rank the priorities of positions for attention in the summer transfer window? These are the likely areas. Central midfield, central attacking midfield, right back, left back, backup goalkeeper, striker, plus any other areas you think we might be interested in. So what's your priority?
I think it is central attacking midfielder. I know obviously Odegaard's there playing that position at the moment, but I do think securing him, retaining him, or an equivalent is what I think the priority is. What's your number one priority?
I'm slightly torn between the centre of midfield, where I think we need, if we really want to make progress, we need to upgrade in that area. and centre half, where I think we need to produce some or find a partnership as much as possible that, that can, you know, be present for most of our games, if you know what I mean. I know it's a squad game right now, but I do think that the centre of defence is an area that I would be keen to see an upgrade in or you know, a new direction in. And, you know, maybe we have that player, and we've spoken about him before in terms of, you know, what we do with William Saliba. So maybe that's what we do there. But I think...
If not, that is a big one, I think, right? So it's and a half, for sure.
It is a big one, yeah. It is. Because we've got the left side. We've got Gabriel, we've got Pablo Murray. And we have Rob Holding, and we currently have David Luiz, who, you know, I just don't think we should give a new deal to. I just don't. And I know he's played well and everything else, but I just... there's too much risk involved in that for me. And I like my blood pressure low when I'm watching Arsenal, which I know is kind of counterproductive or counterintuitive to say, given what this team puts us through. But I do think that. But if I was really, really pushed to choose one, it would be a central midfield player who comes in alongside Partey and is, you know, an improvement and an upgrade on what we have already. On Xhaka, who, you know, it's not to denigrate him, but I think most people would say if we had a player who was a bit more mobile, who could pass it in the same way, who had, you know, attributes, perhaps more ball-winning attributes. I don't know exactly who the player is, but somebody to partner Partey. Mm. I think that's where my priority would be.
Interesting. Yeah, I think both of those are on the list for sure. I just feel like, and maybe people say, well, we've got Smith Rowe, or we've got Bukayo Saka, who could potentially play as that kind of number 10. But I just think Odegaard has unlocked something in this Arsenal team, and consequently, that's why he's number one for me. But the right side of centre half thing, that would be right up there.
Mm.
I just think that between whatever you may think of the possibility of extending Luiz, between that option and the option of recalling William Saliba, and maybe even at a push of playing Callum Chambers there, I think you have got kind of hashtag internal solutions
to
that particular,
I know what you mean,
issue.
And whereas, for example, we have to do something about the goalkeeper, or the backup goalkeeper at least, right? We have to. We have to get a left back to understudy
Kieran. I think we absolutely have to, yeah. I mean, goalkeeper, you know, you could chance your arm, you know, but we literally haven't got a left back.
Yeah.
Apart from
I know people talk about right back a lot, but like you just said, with we've got loads of them. We do. I mean, we literally have three players who can play in that position, whereas we have one player
out on loan.
Yeah, and one player who can play at left back. I know Cedric can do a job there, but we're talking about players in their natural position. So, you know, for me, right back, while I, you know, if you offered me an upgrade, I take it. But I think we will have to cut our cloth a little bit this summer and focus on the areas that absolutely need, you know, the squad to be bolstered in. And that is left back. That is a backup goalkeeper. I mean, it just strikes me that we'll probably sign Matt Ryan, will we?
Maybe. It feels kind of straightforward, doesn't it? And I think he's made a positive impression. People seem to like him and think he's decent. So, yeah, make sense.
What's his contract
situation?
He's got
another year. I think he's got one more year at Brighton. I'll just double check that now. But I think that is the case.
Contract expire? Oh, hang on. No, 2022.
One more year.
One more year.
But
so cheap.
I mean, he's not going to cost a huge amount of money, is he?
No.
And if they were prepared to let him go on loan, you know, I think there's definitely a deal to be done there. To be honest, it's interesting. Central midfield, I do think there's going to be a numerical issue. You know, if we say Torreira and Guendouzi won't be involved, and we say Ceballos goes back, I think you have to wonder what sort of role Joe Willock will play next season, if at all, at Arsenal. And then Mohamed Elneny, I think, will be maybe a year from the expiry of his deal at Arsenal. So there'll be a decision on him too. I do think numerically we do need someone in that area. So I can see why that figure's high on your list. The last one, centre forward, I'm less and less confident that Arsenal will sign a centre forward this summer. I just think the way things are going, there are a few different things happening that make that seem unlikely.
Okay, such as?
So one is Aubameyang playing there more regularly.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes a big difference.
And that's what should happen, I think. I know people have had issues with his form, but when you go large on a player's contract like that at the age of 31, you don't have him chasing up and down the wing because, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. You know, and it doesn't make any sense within the system that we've begun to play with these technical players behind a striker. It makes a lot of sense to have someone like Aubameyang there. So that's, yeah, okay, that's one.
That's number one. Number two is that the sort of whispers and hints about Gabriel Martinelli potentially being considered as an option in that position. I think that might have an influence. And then number three is my growing hunch that Lacazette stays. Not gets a new deal.
Doesn't get a new deal. Okay.
Yeah.
I did see some stuff over the weekend that there was some whispers that he might get a new deal. I think what we do in the transfer market at centre forward entirely depends on Lacazette and what we decide to do with him.
Nketiah will go regardless, I think.
I think Eddie will go, yeah. I think, you know, the last
actually, in terms
months-
of raising money,
mm-hmm.
some of these young academy players are maybe our best bet. I mean, if you put Lacazette and Nketiah on the market this summer, I think there's every chance Nketiah fetches more money. Is that unrealistic? I just wonder with the sort of premium on young English players.
I mean, are Bournemouth going to buy him? I mean, if they do, you know, they've spent a load of money on...
Yeah.
You know.
Let's hope Bournemouth buy him, because given some of the fees they've spent for the players.
Could we just get Liverpool to sell Eddie Nketiah fourth? How about that? Because they get remarkable money for their young players who have done far less than Eddie has. You know, this is England under 21's record goal scorer. He scored goals for us in the Premier League and in the Europa League. So I think there's definitely value in him, but it depends on, you know, who's got money out there and is willing to spend it on him.
I mean, Liverpool sold Rian Brewster for 20 million, didn't they?
Yeah.
He's not scored a Premier League goal this season in 20 games. So, yeah, if they were up for kind of being a middleman on the deal, I'd be all for it. But what I was saying is I do wonder if the young English players are Arsenal's best chance of bringing some cash this summer, even if their value has diminished a bit of late.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, Maitland-Niles, Nketiah, Willock.
Nelson.
Could all go for pretty decent money. Lacazette is what? He's 29. He's going to be 30 in May, with a year left on his deal. Mm. So, look, has he only got 16 caps for France? Is that all?
Yeah, he's really barely figured for France. Right. It is interesting.
Yeah, because I was going to say, like, an international player, blah, 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 but, you know, he hasn't played for France in a long time. Yeah. I think probably there's somebody out there who would take him for a reasonable amount of money, but it depends on what we could get for that money if we're going to reinvest it back in there. I mean, I don't think we should be, you know, giving him a new deal.
If it was up to me, I would sell him.
Yeah,
to be
would,
clear. If there was a buyer at a good price, to be honest, pretty much any price that was worth reinvesting, I would do that deal.
Mm.
But I just wonder, thinking about Arteta and looking at how Arsenal have held on to players in a couple of transfer windows already, if he does let Nketiah go, I wonder if he'll justify this kind of security blanket of Lacazette for another 12 months for the sake of, I don't know, whatever it will be, 10 to 15 million quid. I wonder if he'll...
What about Balogun? Game over?
Personally, I think so.
I mean, if Nketiah is going and Aubameyang is 31, you know.
Yeah.
You could sell him on the pathway. Yeah.
There's definitely a pathway. Or you could say, sign a new contract and you're going out on loan to a Premier League club where you'll play more regularly. I mean, that's what I would be selling to him. I'd be saying, have a new deal and guess what? You're going to spend 2 years on loan playing real football while we, you know, see out Aubameyang's contract and use Martinelli. I just wonder, you know, knowing what we know about Arteta, and I think he does have a tendency towards experience in some scenarios. I don't think he'd be happy with Aubameyang, Martinelli and Balogun as his strikers.
No, I don't think so. I think he would want something
else. A more experienced option, I think. And that's why I'm starting to wonder if he'll go, I need to keep Lacazette. Sorry, Edu. Don't know. Time will tell. Again, it's very tricky because a lot depends on what the market's like, you know.
What about, you know, if you sell Lacazette and Inter Milan go broke and you bring in Lukaku? Would you like that?
That'd be nice. Are they going broke?
I think so.
I mean, Lukaku is reportedly on Manchester City's list.
But they don't use strikers anymore. So
that's true, actually. They've evolved beyond the position. I mean, Lukaku's been astonishing for Inter. Really, really good. I can't see that, sadly.
No.
But, you know, it'd be nice. We have to find the new Lukaku, the Christian Benteke's of this world. Uncover a rough diamond.
Yes, we're going to have to do that. Look, it's going to be a hugely interesting summer, isn't it?
Well, it really is. What about this question from Niall on that note, who's at Twittoo on Twitter. After reassessing Edu's summer and winter performance, what grade are you giving him and what confidence, I guess more importantly, do you have in him moving forward?
I am less unconfident than I was.
Yeah?
But I need to see more before I could become confident in itself. Right? Because I do think, like, last summer's transfer window was just mental. It was crazy. You know, I think not that we've forgotten, how could we forget? But, you know, everything was just so weird and bizarre and surreal and difficult. And
particularly at Arsenal.
Yeah. You know, there was a lot going on. All the circumstances of everything that had happened over the, you know, the previous 2 years, 18 months, 2 years, and even for a couple of years before that, right? You know, there was a need for some kind of reset and rebuild, which I think everybody was, you know, on board with to various degrees. You know, how much you wanted to raise it all to the ground and build it up again, that fluctuated, right? Mm-hmm. But I do think last summer's transfer window, there were things we didn't do well, but it's hard to look beyond the circumstances. And also, I think, look, the pandemic, and then there was the Raul Sanyehi thing and all of that kind of stuff. None of that helped. None of it helped.
No.
The January transfer window is never really a good one anyway to make any sort of judgments on. But they sorted out the Ozil situation, which was like a cloud hanging over the club.
Yeah,
whether you loved Ozil or didn't love him, you have to admit that that was not a healthy situation for anyone, for the club, for the player, for the fan base, for anyone. It was just completely unhealthy. So they sorted that out. They got rid of Mustafi, which I have to say gets a big tick from me. Kolasinac also gone. Whether we can shift him this summer or we just let him stay at Schalke, just say, no, keep him. No, it's fine. Is yours, you keep him. It's absolutely
tricky
fine.
Because
we don't,
they look like they're very much headed for relegation.
They do.
And I, I fear that they won't be able to pay Kolasinac's wages. No. If that's the case.
The Socrates situation also sorted, you know, and I think he was. I think he was kind of a bit, you know, it was a bit unfair in certain ways how he was. What's the word I'm looking for? Portrayed. Right, you know, I think he was just a good, honest pro, you know, decent player, not great, but far less error prone than someone like Mustafi, who played, you know, quite a bit more, because there were elements of his game which Arteta liked better, you know, on the ball, etc., etc. But, you know, so, and obviously the Odegaard thing was a real coup. It was a really, really good piece of business.
Yeah.
So, the inexperience, I think, that we have concerns about when it comes to Edu and Arteta and Edu's role. I know he did a similar kind of job at Corinthians, but in terms of managing player arrivals and departures and those kind of things in the European game, he was really inexperienced. Arteta is still, you know, an inexperienced coach/manager, and all the upheaval that was happening in the world and at the football club and all the finances that, you know. So I think they had a really difficult job to do. I'm, like I say, I'm a bit more encouraged than I was, you know, at the end of the transfer. I mean, Partey's good business as well, but we probably should have done it, you know, in the summer. If we were going to do it, we probably should have done it sooner than we did. You know, if we were going to shell out that money, just fucking do it and get him in for the start of the season. The release clause was the release clause. I know we were trying to do stuff with Awa and what have you, but, you know, maybe you might look back on that as a recruitment duo and think we should have done that slightly differently, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm cautiously optimistic. Would that be reasonable to say?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there are different interpretations of his work in January. I mean, on the one hand, yes, he did get rid of a lot of the players who were deemed surplus to requirements, which was fantastic.
But then he basically just paid them to go away.
He did that by just paying them, yeah. And, I mean,
we had to pay them anyway. We would have had to pay them if they stayed, so...
That's true, but like, you know, for example, with the Urza one, on the one hand, it's like, wow, you know, a lot of people tried and failed to solve that problem, and Edu did, but he also solved it in the most straightforward way possible by basically paying the guy. And yeah,
what he wanted.
Yeah, no,
that's
I know.
Wanted.
But I do wonder, like, if at any point we'd gone to any of those players and said, we'll pay you what's left in your contract, might have succeeded. I don't know.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, look, you're right. It wasn't the most sophisticated thing. But I think in terms of, I just meant shaping the squad and sort of, you know, getting rid of some of the elements which weren't conducive to, you know, the harmony and togetherness that you want, you know, to give the manager a group of players. I think that's the sidebar to that. Okay, it's easy to say, here's some money, fuck off. But the benefit of that is that you have a smaller squad and a much more manageable squad.
Yeah, I liked it from kind of a technical perspective. You know what I mean? Even if there are question marks over it from a business perspective, I like that it was a decision made for the manager, really. It was to say, you know, here's a squad that's more manageable, a squad that you actually want to work with, and we are prepared as a club to sacrifice certain things to make that happen. I like that. And yeah, the Odegaard business is really good. The Matt Ryan business looks like a very sensible, reasonable piece of business. So that is encouraging. And there's kind of an interesting balance, I suppose, between those two signings, of sort of one being a young player with elite pedigree who could potentially help take this team to the next level, and another one being someone with Premier League experience who's probably come in relatively cheaply, who is filling a spot in the squad. And I think going forward, there's going to have to be a bit of that kind of column A, column B approach from Arsenal. You know, maybe they can sign a top class right-sided centre-back, but it yeah. means when they're looking for their backup left-back, they have to cut their cloth a little bit more. You know, I can't see a scenario where we just get our number one choice in every area of the pitch. So I think that's encouraging that Edu's shown a bit of diversity of approach there. He's also stopped signing players from the same agent over and over again, so that helps.
For now, anyway.
For now, yeah. Let's see what the summer brings. What were you going to ask me, sorry?
I was going to ask you, are you confident or are you... Do you feel like there is, at least in the minds of those responsible for the work that needs to happen, a clear plan as to what needs to happen?
I think I am actually relatively confident on that, simply because there was a lot of discussion last summer about this kind of projected idea of where the team was going. You know, that they were going to end up playing more of a 4-3-3 or 4-2-3-1, which they weren't really playing at the time. They started the season with three at the back, as long ago as that seems. And we have seen some of those evolutionary steps actually take place this season, which is positive. I also think something like the left-back situation, you know, everybody in the club was aware that's something that needed to be addressed, but a strategic decision was taken to address it in the summer. And actually, I was okay with that because I kind of feel like, well, if that enables you to do the right deal, get the right player, then so be it. I guess I have confidence that having both had their feet under the table.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
For a little bit of time now, and seemingly having some sort of rapport, that Arteta and Edu will at least have kind of a shared vision and a shared idea of where they want to take this team.
That's what,
which maybe hasn't been the case for a while.
I mean, I think a lot of Arsene's transfer business was much like the football, kind of improvised, you know what I mean?
Yeah
It was like, oh, this guy's available. Oh, sometimes, you know, we have to go and we have to get a central defender, we need to, but then, you know, we do a thing like Mustafi, so, you know, the efficacy of the business wasn't great, but there were times, I think, where, you know, you can remember, I'm sure, very well, when we were when we signed Andre Arshavin. Mm-hmm. Pretty much everybody was saying we need to sign a defender or a defensive midfielder
in the January transfer.
Everybody, and then he goes and buys a 5'7" playmaker. You know, so I'm not sure how. I mean, obviously there was a plan in his mind, but, you know, maybe it only made sense in his mind as well. Whereas I think there's definitely a structure, isn't there, to the way that Arteta wants to work. And I think in terms of the way he wants to play, he has spoken about wanting to play 4-3-3. He has spoken about the need for, what did he call it, specificity in certain positions and you know, how important that is to helping him play the way he wants to play. So with that in mind, you have to think that while they may not know exactly who, they must certainly know what they want. You know what I mean? So
yeah, absolutely. So I guess, like you, cautiously optimistic. This is going to be a boring thing that we'll keep saying probably between now and the summer, but it is just difficult to anticipate what the levels of expenditure are going to be and how that will impact, you know, everybody. But within that, could, you know, setting that to one side, I'm much more positive about Edu than I was a few months ago, shall we say.
Okay. All right. Well, look, I'll tell you what we'll do is we will leave part one. Right there, I was trying to figure out which part of the podcast it was. That's how strange my mind is. So, yes, it is part one. And coming next, we'll have part four. But we're going to take a break. And in between that, there'll be three other parts. And then we'll come back with your questions and more in part two, right after this. Welcome back to part two of this interlull, Arscast Extra, and this is the part of the show where we answer your questions, but we've already been doing that in part one, so this is the part of the show where we answer more of your questions that you send to us on Twitter, at GunnerBlog and at ArsBlog, and also on the ArsBlog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an ArsBlog member on Patreon. For Patreon members, watch out tomorrow for a new episode of the podcast, Statements, in which I speak to a guest. We do statements, and they have to either agree, disagree, strongly agree, or strongly disagree with those statements. For example, Willian is brilliant. And you have to either agree, strongly disagree, or vehemently disagree while hitting me over the head with a hammer. That's available for Patreon members tomorrow. You can sign up if you like. Patreon.com/arsblog. Right. We're going to get into this one straight away, James. Mm-hmm. We're going in for the kill, the big, big one. And it is from the, I think it's from the Discord. It comes from Chris. And Chris says, what are your predictions for the run-in to the end of the season? This is something you have done previously, and this season, more than any other I can remember, it will be desperately difficult to predict. But, but, you signed up to do podcasts, and this is your penance. So, I'll go through the fixtures.
Okay, remember to write them down somewhere.
I am writing them down. I've got
lose.
The one that I will lose, okay. And somebody will have to go back and listen to this podcast and then send me a spreadsheet, which I will then lose, and we'll never reference it again. But we'll do the predictions. So here we go, starting with how many games have we got? Of 1, 2, 3, 10.
Are we doing
10?
Just Premier League?
Yeah, just Premier League. Just Premier League. Come on.
Okay.
Okay, so Liverpool at home. What is your prediction for Liverpool at home?
Call me crazy, but I'm going to say an Arsenal win.
Wow. Okay, a win.
Just a feeling. Just a feeling on that one.
Okay. I am a little less crazy, but I do think we can get a draw from this game.
Okay.
I think we can get a draw. So, Sheffield United away. What's your thoughts on that one?
So, my thoughts are, obviously, Sheffield United aren't particularly good. It's the sort of game Arsenal absolutely should win, but it's also the kind of game I can imagine them not winning.
Right.
I'm going to go for a draw.
Okay. I am going to go for a win in that game.
Okay. So we're level pegging, really, ultimately.
I do see your point, though, about that kind of fixture being problematic for us.
It's 7 o'clock on a Sunday as well.
Oh, no. I changed my mind. 7 o'clock on a Sunday, that's a draw. I'm sorry. I can't. I just can't go for a win in that schedule. That's good. It's fucking bastard fucking Sunday night. Okay.
Then it's Fulham.
Fulham at home. I think we're going to win that one.
I think so too.
Okay. The next game is Everton at home.
I think we will draw.
Draw. See, I have a feeling we're going to get a little kick in one of the fixtures, and I have a... it could be that one. So I think we're going to lose to Everton at home.
Okay.
Some kind of David Luiz red card penalty incident, something like that.
How can it be an own goal and a red card? It just can. He's finally managed it.
Newcastle away.
Oh, I think Arsenal will win.
Okay. Newcastle away. I think we'll also win that one.
They're not very good.
West Brom at home.
Has to be a win.
Has to be a win. Sorry, Ainsley. Sorry, Joe. But we've just beaten you in the last two games. Chelsea away.
A loss, I'm afraid.
Yeah. That's what I'm going for, too. Crystal Palace away.
That could be anything, couldn't it?
Yeah.
I just lost to Chelsea. I'll say that we'll win that.
Okay.
I don't believe it, but I'll say it.
I'm going to take a draw in that one.
Yeah. And then I think we'll beat Brighton.
I think we'll beat Brighton on the final day of the season with fans back. Will fans be back? Could fans be back in the stadium?
Hopefully some.
So you've gone for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 wins from our last 10 games and 2 draws, which gives us 20 points. Is that right? 6,
yeah,
3
is
18,
bad, is
20. And I've gone for 1, 2, 3, 4 wins. 1, 2, 3, 4 wins. 1, 2, 3 draws. Whew. So much fewer points, 15 for me.
I think 1, 2, yours might be more 1, accurate.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3. Yeah, 15. Yeah. Well,
that would take us to what, respectively?
Where are we at the moment?
That would be... we are on 42 points.
So 62 for you. And 57 for me.
Mm.
That took a long time to add 42 and 15. In my mind,
it did take you a while.
Did I was looking at the numbers, going, these don't make any sense.
It's actually this. Actually, guys, this sum is impossible. this sum just doesn't go.
Yeah, there's no possible way those two numbers can be added together to create another number.
Well.
I've just broken.
So I guess if you get that many points, the league will be voided because it'll be an impossible number. I mean,
look, it doesn't matter anyway because we're going to win the Europa League. So.
Well, that's the thing. You know, it does feel like a pointless exercise, given that we are winning that.
Yeah. But you got to go through the motions. You have to.
I suppose. It's for the listeners, really, you know?
That's what we do. That's what we committed to as podcasters, to make...
Exactly. We've made our bed.
Yeah.
Terrible. Now we need to do predictions in it.
Yeah.
So what about this question, seeing as it's the Interlal? Jay Alex, who's at JordanAM1988, says, what is your best memory of an Arsenal player in international football?
I think it's Emmanuel Petit.
Yeah.
In the 1998 World Cup final. He scored the third goal, didn't he? Petit was...
set up by Vieira, yeah. I believe.
Petit, not my favourite player. I thought he was great that double season, but then he just kind of, I don't know, he annoyed me anyway. But at the time, having just won the double Arsenal, and Vieira came on as a substitute, and, you know, France versus Brazil in the final in France, I think that's probably the one that stands out for me. You know, and that's, as I say this as somebody who you know, who's not particularly committed to international football.
Yeah.
I mean, are there any for you?
Standout moments. I mean, that's what I would have said. I mean, Dennis Bergkamp against Argentina.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
that's
yeah.
hard to see past.
Oh, my God. Yeah, the Dennis Bergkamp. And then the commentary, of course.
Frank de Boer speelt de bal. Heel goed naar Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp neemt de bal aan. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp.
I also have fond memories of the summer we signed Thomas Rosicky. Him absolutely belting one in from long range. Maybe against the USA.
It was, yeah. In one of the first games in the World Cup, yeah.
And thinking, oh, he'll be doing that every week, I imagine, in the
and
Premier League.
And he did it pretty early on, didn't he, in a Champions League game? Fairly early on in his Arsenal career.
Yeah, maybe against Dortmund. I'm not sure, but yeah, I remember that, an early long-range goal. But that one in the World Cup was extraordinary.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's probably loads that we're not thinking of, but, you know, it's hard to remember these things when they happen for not Arsenal, You know what I mean?
Yes, yes. But, you know, there have been a couple of happy memories along the way. Arsenal winning the World Cup in 1998, though. It doesn't get much better than that.
That is true. That is true. Let me ask you these questions then.
Yes.
From Aubameyang FC, who's at Aviv_Levy, who says, morning, gents. Do you think having the World Cup in the winter next year will adversely affect Arsenal's rebuild? We all know how important next season is for us. Do Premier League clubs with fewer international stars have an advantage? And then this one from... I got to find it here. It's in my Twitter, and I can't find it. But I'll look for it again. So ask that one, answer that one, and I'll find the other question.
I mean, do we have loads of internationals? Loads more than other Premier League teams? I'm not sure.
I feel like we used to have more.
Yeah, we used to have a lot. And then now, you know, there are plenty of players in the current squad who probably wouldn't be involved in a World Cup. So we might be less adversely affected than some of our immediate rivals. But a Winter World Cup will obviously be mental and weird, and mean that no season will really feel like a proper season for years and years.
It's mad, isn't it? Because, I mean, what is the schedule? Because, I mean, last season didn't really feel like a proper season because of the way it was interrupted, right?
Yeah.
And we had the lockdown, and then football recommenced, and this season doesn't feel like a proper season at all because there's no fans in the stadiums. People can't go to games. So, you know, it doesn't feel real. And next season is going to feel bizarre given that it's going to start and then stop.
Group stage kicks off 21st of November 2022.
How far in advance of that are players who are involved in the World Cup
obliged to meet up?
Going to meet up? And at what point does that then impact top level football? Like, when does it?
It's got to be 2 or 3 weeks, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
So that takes you to sort of the start of November. So you've basically got
2 months,
September, October. Yeah.
So it's going to be 2 months if the World Cup runs for a month.
Oh, 2 months break. Yeah. Yeah. But I meant 2 months probably before the break.
And then what do they do? Are they going to squeeze in the rest of the season? I mean, are they going to have to, are they going to do anything to offset the impact on either the schedule or how many games have got to be played? Like, are we going to have a League Cup? Are we going to have two-legged European ties? Are they going to adjust certain things about the football calendar to keep the calendar the way it is currently, in that, like,
no
new season is going to start in August? Or are they going to do something mad? I don't know.
Yeah, you'd like to think that they'll make some adaptations, but it will be odd, for sure. Yeah, it will be. And I do think that the next few years, I mean, they announced last week, didn't they, how long the gap's going to be, I think, between the end of this season and the start of next. And it's a relatively swift turnaround again. So where players will feel... how players will feel by kind of, you know, spring 23, I have no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, the less of our players, what I really want is all our players to kind of retire from international duty, ideally.
But that's the thing, the best players, if you want the best players, they play for their countries. That's the reality.
I know.
You know? So we can't avoid it. The other question I was going to ask is from David McNamara, who's at DVDMCN, who says, are you a bit disappointed that there hasn't been a single player during this interlull to come out and say, fuck the World Cup, I'm not going to dance on the graves of 6,000 migrant workers and just opt out of playing World Cup qualifiers? And just to sort of correct that tweet, it's 6,500 migrant workers reportedly have died in Qatar since, you know,
It is surreal as well, seeing international teams kind of protest while attempting to qualify for the tournament. Like, there is something... I guess it's better to protest than to not, but there is a kind of hypocrisy almost in... You're kind of endorsing it and protesting at the same time, it seems to me.
But. Yeah, it is a difficult one, and it's, you know, some would say, you know, using the platform to raise the issue is good, and I suppose it is in some ways. It is mad when you read the articles and you read the news stories that, you know, leaving aside the fact that the World Cup has had such a, is going to have such a big impact on the football calendar. Like the fact, you know, that it's being played in the middle of a season, which is just wrong in my opinion. But, you know, 6,500 people have died. And I don't quite know how to put this other than it's not just 6,500 people that are affected by that. You know, you can read the article and say, well, 6,500, that's an awful lot of people, but doesn't really affect me and I want to watch the World Cup and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, each one of those people has family and friends and mothers and fathers and children and all of those things, you know, so it's way more than the impact of this is way more than just, and I say just 6,500 people losing their lives, but it's an extraordinary, heartbreaking thing to think that this sporting event, which is going to be watched by millions and billions and used to generate huge amounts of revenue and income, you know, for FIFA, for footballers, for brands, for all of those things, that the cost of that is people's lives. It is obscene, really. And now that I'm talking about it and speaking about it and thinking about it, it's just wrong, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I'd like to think that Arsenal players, as the question asked, will kind of take their stand against it.
Well, not just Arsenal players. I mean, footballers in general. I mean...
Oh, of course, of course. Sorry, I thought the question...
No. I mean, yeah. I mean, it is heartening in some ways that you know, there is talk. I mean, I read that the Norwegian national team are... There's very strong calls for them to boycott the World Cup.
Right.
But, you know, whether it happens or not, whether national associations will allow that to happen, because, you know, ultimately, you know, they generate and they get money from these events as well. So, you know, people will say, you know, the best thing you can do is actually, you know, go there and, you know, use your voice and use your platform to protest and raise the issue, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas the strongest thing I think you could do is just have no part of it.
Mm-hmm.
That is the strongest protest you could make.
I agree, but I think, like you, there won't be many, if any, who do that.
I agree.
And even in a footballer's career, a short career, the fact is most of them want to play in World Cups, and I think most will. But I think we will see, I'm confident we will see forms of protest, you know, associated with the tournament. But it is a very unpleasant situation. It's awful, to be honest, those numbers about the migrant workers who've died there. It's just so depressing to hear about.
Yeah. You know, we all love football and we all love the World Cup and everything else, but...
We've all become slightly inured to thousands of people dying.
Yeah. And the idea of indentured labour, basically.
True. You know? And the inherent kind of conflict in, you know, following football and supporting football, you know, there are inevitable kind of ethical questions that you encounter due to, like, business associations that we kind of shrug at collectively.
Look at our sponsor.
Exactly.
You know?
But... this instance, with it being the World Cup and with that standing for having certain, you know, you'd like to think anyway, having certain sort of place and prominence in the game, it is a kind of particularly egregious example of that conflict between everything that's good about football and everything that's bad.
Mm. Yeah.
By the way, on that kind of note of ethics and football, I haven't seen a question about this, but what did you make of Thierry Henry's decision to step away from social media? And do you think we'll see any other kind of high-profile sports people doing that?
I think when someone like Thierry Henry does that, it's you know, like, it's like, okay, it's not the same as not going to the World Cup, but it's probably more impactful than just saying racism is bad or abuse is bad or, you know, on your social media account. Like, ultimately, I don't think, what's the right way to put this? Like, I don't think it, you know, Thierry Henry doesn't need social media. He doesn't depend on social media in any way.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, his brand is built, his presence is enormous, everyone knows who he is, etc., etc. So I'm not saying it's easy for him to do what he did, but, you know, he's in a position where, you know, he can walk away from Twitter and he can walk away from Instagram, and it's not really going to make a big deal to his life. But if that gesture can get a conversation going about the unwillingness of social media networks to properly deal with issues of abuse, then I think it's great, because it is it's an ongoing problem. It's an ongoing issue. You know, and we can all pull up hundreds and hundreds of examples of how awful it can be. And they don't deal with people who are abusive and people who are racist and people who are sexist and people who are misogynistic and people who are all kinds of bigots and express those views. They don't get dealt with the way that they should, you know?
No, not at all.
Yeah, well, did you see the thing in the there was a, could have been The Guardian last week, where they did a big dive on Facebook moderation.
Right.
And
didn't see it, no.
Right, but one of the things was it's okay to wish death on a minor local celebrity as long as you don't tag them into it.
Sorry for laughing.
I mean, you know, look, I
that explains all those posts about me.
Yeah, exactly. but, you know,
yeah, wow, that's extraordinary.
Yeah. So I think, you know, there is clearly a need for them to do more. And I think he used the phrase powers that be or something like that, or the authorities, which I think is a slightly different conversation. You know, I'm not sure it's something that needs to be regulated by government or something like that, but there needs to be a set
of... The businesses themselves.
Yeah. Apply some fucking standards. Apply some standards, you know, and don't allow somebody who is blatantly racist or whatever to continue to use your service. Simple as that. I know it's not easy, and there are ways around things, and, you know, people say, well, you should have to, like, use your real name, and you have to, you know, use ID or whatever to get a social media account. Yeah. That's problematic for a couple of reasons, because, you know, there are reasons why being anonymous on social media is a good thing, and it can be helpful for a lot of people. And, you know, not everybody has the freedom to express themselves the way that we do. The other thing is that there are a lot of people out there who are quite happy to use their real names and be absolute wankers.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's true.
So it doesn't get rid of those people. Oh, that's my real name, and I'm going to do this. Now what? You know what I mean? So there is a need, clearly, for them to do more and to be stricter. And I think the example that he used, where he said if they were as quick to deal with, you know, abusive people or racist, you know, as they do with somebody posting a 5-second GIF of a goal, you know.
Yeah.
There are other vested interests at play there, though, of course, you know, Premier League and, you know, the rights holders and all those kind of things. And ultimately, what are we going back to but money?
No, and I applaud him taking a stand. I mean, he shouldn't have to take that, measure.
Mm.
But it does need to change. And I wouldn't be surprised if other athletes follow suit, given the fact that Thierry Henry's done this and how well thought of he is and how much frustration and anger and hurt people feel about the fact that this kind of behaviour is tolerated. Let's hope it's the start of something. Again, the cynic in me fears not, and the social media world will continue turning without Thierry Henry, but I applaud him for trying to take a stand.
Okay, let's fly through a few just before we go.
Yeah.
Another 10 minutes and we'll whiz through some questions. Arsenal Cannon Picks, who's at Ars Cannon Picks, says, maybe I'm just a miserable git, but does it annoy you when we celebrate goals for years that ultimately led to nothing, i.e. the Welbeck header versus Leicester and our Xhavin against Barcelona? Undoubtedly wonderful moments at the time, but forever replayed for no reason.
I saw this question too. I have to say it doesn't annoy me at all. I think that football is about those moments, and if you can't derive satisfaction or joy from them, it's not only about the winning. And think of all the clubs who haven't won very much at all. And yeah, it doesn't mean that those supporters don't have points along that journey that they revere or look back on fondly or admire.
I mean, I don't think he's saying you can't enjoy them in the moment, because obviously you do, but it's the replaying of them. Like, I see kind of what he means about the Welbeck Leicester one, even though that was a genuinely brilliant moment in the stadium. I remember being there that day and it was incredible. But, something like, because you look at that Welbeck header and I just think regret. Of that season,
sure.
It's not that brilliant of a goal, that it should be replayed all the time. I don't know that it is. That's the other part.
I think that's a fair one in that, like, there is regret with that because it was as much about the missed opportunity. But say the Arshavin one, right? Arsenal went out of that tie, didn't they, in the second leg? But
I mean, can you not look at that goal over and over and over again and just not be filled with the most pure football joy possible? Because A, it's a brilliant goal. It's against probably the best team in Europe at that time. We won the game and Arshavin runs off, lifts up his shirt to reveal a t-shirt of himself on the shirt while arm in arm with Nicholas Bentner. I mean, how can you just not look at that and think football is just beautiful sometimes?
I agree. I don't think it's like I'm trying to think, but the Welbeck one, I understand the issue because it kind of precipitated effectively a failure.
Mm.
But I don't think we're, as a fan base, guilty of sort of celebrating goals we scored in defeats. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that there are small victories along the way.
Other clubs.
We all know. The North London Derby, yeah, exactly. But I just think, even with the Welbeck one, yes, there's regret there, but anyone who was there that day did experience something really thrilling and really exciting, and I understand why it lives on in the memory, even if it is tinged with that sort of sadness.
Okay.
What was I going to ask you? Oh, yes. Mike Michelson at Really Michael says, after his man of the match performance against West Ham.
Michael Michelson.
Yeah. After his man of the match performance against West Ham, do you think Callum Chambers could go on to be a starter for the remaining games this season? And then he says, and what player has the best story of having to wait a long time for their chance? Is it Francis Coquelin? # late bloomers.
Does he have a chance? I mean, I think he probably has a role to play between now and the end of the season, for sure. And clearly, Arteta must see something in him that he views as useful for specific games and specific opponents. I think we said this last week, didn't we, that, when we were 3-0 down against West Ham, I was like, oh, well, now we're fucked. Not just because we're 3-0 down, but you've picked a right back to give you defensive solidity against a team that's good in the air, and we're probably going to need to change that. And I didn't see that coming from Callum Chambers in terms of what he delivered in the final third. So I think he probably has a role to play.
Do you think, I mean, Nono CIO on Discord says, do you think it's in the club's best interest to play Chambers significantly more so that we know where we stand on him and can make a decision on this in the summer? Do you think we need to see more in order to make a judgment?
Maybe we need to see more to make a judgment.
Yeah, I wonder if
Arteta and the coaching staff know fine well what they think of him and what he can do and where he can do it. So maybe for us as fans to, like, because the one thing we dislike as football fans is a grey area. We like to know things definitively, you know? So you can nail your colours to a particular mast and stick by it and never change your opinion even when facts prove otherwise, as is the way of the world these days, you know? But I think we struggle with those. We struggle with those grey areas. And it's quite interesting in that you can have a position on a player which can change radically in the space of one game or two games or three games. You know, here's a good example. When Mohamed Elneny played brilliantly against Manchester United earlier in the season alongside Thomas Partey in that game that we won.
Manchester United, yep, exactly.
Everyone was like, ooh. And now, I really wanted us to sell Elneny, but, you know, if he could do that a bit more. You know, he could be a pretty useful player for us. And, oh, well, it turns out, he's still kind of who he is. And he's fine, and he's safe, and he, you know, keeps the ball moving. And, oh, he scored a rocket of a goal in the Europa League. Now, if he could do that a little bit more for you know what I mean? So we fluctuate on players. I think Chambers will play some games between now and the end of the season. I think he might be used. He could even be used at centre half, like you said. So, what was the question again? I've forgotten.
Could he go on to be a starter? And is it in the club's interest to play him more?
You know, I don't know about the interest of the club. I think we just pick the best players that we have available for the games that we have ahead. I don't know that we, you know, you play Callum Chambers in a game to, like, raise his profile and see if you can generate a bit more cash. That's not your thinking. Your thinking is, I need to pick a team that's going to win this game, you know?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I do wonder. I would like to see him play right-sided centre-half between now and the end of the season when the opportunity presents itself, just because, you know, we're going to learn more from that than we are from picking David Luiz again, for example. So I would like to see that, but that's me being nosy, and maybe the club feel, as you said, they already know what they think about the player. We'll have to wait and see.
Okay, Ian, who's at IanBH7 on Twitter, says, why are two left-footed player, or why two left-footed centre-backs playing together doesn't make sense, yet two right-footed centre-backs play together all the time?
I think we've talked about this before, but I genuinely... It just doesn't, is the answer.
Yep.
No, I think if I had to actually give a logical answer, what I would say is I think left-footed players often tend to be slightly more one-footed than right-footed players because they're allowed to emphasise their strength, as it were, and sort of focus and play almost exclusively on the left-hand side.
With their cultured left foot.
Yeah, I just think, you know, it's quite easy to play this game, but you think about Arsenal and you think of, you know, Jack Wilshere or Granit Xhaka to an extent. I think there is a sort of permissiveness. I mean, they, you know, Xhaka's got a right foot, but he's not close to two-footed. And I think right-footed players generally are more able and more comfortable and more used to playing on their wrong side because they have to. Left-footed players, I mean, I wonder what percentage of people who play football are left-footed.
What I mean, what percentage of
people are left-handed? I think just more people are left-handed than left-footed. I'm left-footed but right-handed, for example.
Okay, so you're a freak then. Yeah, that is weird. Right-handed but left-footed. So, what percentage of people are left-footed? 12% of people are left-footed.
Yeah. You don't have to be very good to be a Premier League footballer if you're left-footed. I could probably get a game, I reckon. Because only 12% of people are left-footed.
Isn't that mad, then, that the other day we had so many left-footed players in the team? If you work it out from a... Not to go back to mathematics again, because I've proved earlier in this show that I'm absolutely terrible at that. But, you know, when you have Odegaard, Saka, Tierney, Xhaka, there was one other, and Pepe... All on
what
the pitch
that
at the
stat
same
doesn't
time.
Tell you is that left-footed players are better. They're just better.
Okay.
Yeah,
I see.
So they're also the best 12%.
I missed that.
Now, it is interesting. I mean, you know, that is an interesting representation thing. On the centre-half thing, I think the solution I gave is the only possible one. And I do think there is just kind of a mistrust, isn't there, of like two left-footed centre-halves?
Yeah, I think so.
That is a kind of cultural thing.
One of those things that just doesn't happen. People just don't do it. You know, it's accepted wisdom. It's like putting just jam on your toast.
Although I would say, when we played Benfica, I think it was the first leg against Benfica, maybe. So it was Luiz and Gabriel, I want to say, at centre-half.
Mm-hmm.
And there were at least a couple of occasions where... In build-up, Gabriel switched out to be the right-sided centre-half. I don't know quite why it happened or how
probably
it ended up
because
Luiz
was, you know, chasing a
just
bee.
Just wandering. Yeah, probably.
Oh, look, a bee!
But I did look at that and think, ooh, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe you could play him there.
No, you can't. You can't do it.
But you can't. It's against the rules of football.
That is why you're not a manager. Even considering that. Just
shows I don't have the credentials.
You don't have it. Alfie Powell says, what's a small thing you like seeing in football that changes absolutely nothing? I like when a player closes down another player with the same number, like if Saka was tackling Son. I have no idea why. Or when the ball goes through the ref's legs, he says.
That's a funny one, closing down someone with the same number. I guess on that note, I quite like when the player playing a certain position has the right squad number on. I just find it satisfying when the team is displayed.
Mm-hmm.
So I enjoy that. Other things that are completely inconsequential.
I like it. Go on.
You need fans in stadiums for this, but ball goes into the fans and fan heads it back. Really, really love that.
I like things like, you know, if there's a free kick being given and a player has the ball in his hand and the guy is, the opposition player is going, throw me the ball, and then you just drop the ball.
Right.
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like things
That's
like that.
Quite funny.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of others that I like.
Consequential things.
Stuff that changes nothing.
I mean, I like little rituals players have. I used to love some of the stuff Jens Lehmann used to do to keep himself warm and flexible and agile during games. Like,
ball would be
up at the other end of the pitch and he'd be doing somersaults in the 6-yard box. That was good fun to watch.
Yeah.
Inconsequential. Oh, I mean, I guess, like, players really aggressively shepherding the ball out of play. Like a centre-half. You know, that is the way Sol Campbell used to do
it. For about, like, 10 yards.
Yeah. For, like, 20 yards. And definitely committing some sort of foul, you would imagine. Like, you know, backing into the player and shoulder charging him and all that stuff. Just to win a goal kick. I do really like that.
Yeah. Good stuff. shoulder charges. You don't see enough of those anymore, the good old-fashioned shoulder bars. I mean, Harry Kane did one on Gabriel's head the other day, but that's not a shoulder. That's a, like, GBH, I think they call that. Shoulder charges.
Let me have a look and see if I had a couple more here. If not, by all means, ask me if you've got some.
I have one here from Party Time. Who's at Party Time?
Mm-hmm.
Time like the herb. Do you say herb or herb?
I say herb.
Mm.
What do you say?
Herb.
What does he say, your party star?
Sorry, I was just thinking about herbs. Herbs, sorry. He says, curveball. I had surgery last week. At the last minute, I was told I couldn't have a general anaesthetic and that I had to be awake during it. I opted to listen to the Arsecast. My question to you both, what's the weirdest times people have listened to the podcast? I can't answer that because I don't know. But I think if people wanted to reply to us on Twitter to tell us what the weirdest ones were, that could be quite fun. We could get some good replies there. I hope it wasn't like heart surgery.
Yeah.
Or anything like that. I don't, you know, I don't like the idea of being awake during surgeries.
Exactly. No, I
don't. It's different now, I think. You know, they can give you the old, what to call it? The thingy. The little tiny thingy that goes in and does the bits.
Oh, robot surgery thing.
Yeah, robots.
Keyhole
surgery, that's it. It's not like the old days where...
Sores.
Yeah, where they had to, like, slice you open. Remember having knee surgery when I was a teenager. And, general anesthetic, gigantic scar on the outside of my right knee. It's good.
Grim. It's good. I know people who listen to the podcast in bed, which I find quite odd because I feel like they're going to drift off. A, they're going to miss all the gold at the end of part two. This stuff. This is like the real pure podcast. But also I sort of worry that we'll somehow permeate their subconscious. Do you know what I mean? Like an Inception type thing.
Yeah. Actually, someone said to me on Twitter over the weekend that they went to sleep listening to the podcast and they had some kind of dream about the Arsecast. And
yeah, I don't like the idea of me creeping around other people's dreams. And nor do they, I imagine.
No. Yeah, it was all about World War II. It was from Simon Spoke on Twitter who said, I had a dream last night that you were narrating a story about finding World War II documents in your uncle's attic. They confirmed Nazi and Arsenal atrocities. Note to self, don't listen to Arsecast Extra and watch Hunting Hitler before going to bed. So it can have an impact.
What a cocktail. Mm. I mean, I also remember someone telling me once that they were going on a trek, like a hike, maybe through the desert or something, and they had backed up a load of podcast episodes of ours to listen to during that. It was like their only connection to the outside world.
Well, there you go. You guys can tell us what is the strangest place that you've listened to the Arsecast, or in the strangest circumstances, I guess. You could have listened to it in a normal place, in the normal way, but perhaps in odd circumstances. I'm inclined to leave it there unless you've got a pressing question that you want answered.
No. I think we've covered it. You know?
We've done our best.
We've muddled through.
Given that it is an interlull and a very quiet interlull at that. So look, it all kicks off again at the weekend. We have Liverpool coming up. We will have Patreon stuff during the week for you. We'll do a Liverpool preview podcast, regular Arsecast on Friday, and all the rest. So just enjoy these final few days of quiet contemplation and no Arsenal, because it's going to be all Arsenal all the time between now and May. So, you know, get your batteries recharged and we'll be here with you for that. So there you go. All right.
Bye-bye, guys.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.